Come on, New Orleans!
Welcome, Gladys and Potties. Let's head back to the beautiful but sweltering New Orleans. And I was sitting in the air-conditioned comfort of my hotel in the French Quarter and was joined by an extraordinary bloke, an African-American named Wilbert Rideau. These days, he's an award-winning journalist whose articles and radio documentaries and film collaborations turn the spotlight on life within one of America's most notorious prisons, Louisiana State Pen, also known as Angola. In 1961, when Wilbert was just 19, he killed a white woman in a moment of panic and confusion following a very botched bank robbery. He was denied a fair trial, was sentenced to death, spent 10 years on death row, before that sentence was commuted to life imprisonment. But over the years, he faced two more trials, two more death sentences, and two more reprieves. It wasn't until 2005 that Wilbert finally walked free after serving, cop this, a total of 44 years in Louisiana state prisons, 12 of them, 12 in solitary confinement. But those years changed him. Having faced the prospect of his own death, he learned to come to terms with it and spent the time educating himself. So this is a story of personal redemption, but it's also about the redemption of the prison, which during his time went from one of the worst, one of the most dangerous, to one of the safest. Wilbert became the first black journalist within Angola and the first black editor of the prison magazine, The Angolite. And under his editorship, it became an uncensored and crusading journal, instrumental in reforming the violent prison and, in a wider sense, the corrupt Louisiana justice system. He's now written his autobiography. It's called In the Place of Justice. And I began our chat by telling Wilbert that it was a great pleasure to meet him.
It's indeed a pleasure to be here. I know you hear a lot of people tell you that, but after 44 years in penitentiary, trust me, I am really, really glad to be sitting here in this hotel with you.
If I passed you on the footpath outside, I wouldn't guess for one millionth of a second that you'd had a long, hard, and in many ways tragic life. You carry it very lightly.
Well, the only thing I controlled during all those years, really, and it's the same thing with everybody else in life, is your attitude, how you look at life and how you regard what's happening to you and as you travel through it. And I decided, and it's a choice you make, that I would be an optimist. And I'm an incurable optimist. I believe in the goodness and the positive aspects of life. I think that it'll all be okay. And, you know, it's a case of whether you look at your life as being, how do they say it, the glass is half full or half empty. I look at it as half full.
Well, but I've known a great many people over the years who have spent long times in prison. But what makes you different is this philosophical attitude. You write of prison as a place of human wreckage with tortured souls and destroyed lives, a place fraught with cruelty and danger. And in the same breath, you talk about people fighting to create meaning for lives in an abnormal place and to find purpose and a measure of satisfaction. A place that can be alive with hope, aspiration, and activity. Now, that will come as a great shock to the listener.
I know. Most people believe the popular perception of prisoners is that they're all locked in perpetual violent struggles, and nothing could be farther than the truth. To be sure, some are locked in violence, but the reason for this is because the movies have shaped the public's perception. And understand, movies are made by directors and producers who've never spent a day in prison, or jail for that matter. It's also shaped by prison reformists who, knowing that they're dealing with an indifferent public and an indifferent news media, they have to reach for extreme examples to try to shock you into action. And the third part of this unfortunate situation are the penal administrators. They're always projecting prisoners as being the worst of the worst in order to keep the money coming. They want you to believe that these people are irrevocably evil and dangerous. And that's not so. They're people. They're like people everywhere else. And the majority are not that way. The majority reach a point in life where they would like to be better than who they were.
The other people who are demonized in popular culture, apart from the prisoners, are the prison officers, the screws. Are you equally kind-hearted in your views of them?
Yes. I mean, I wouldn't say it's kind-hearted. I look at it as being realistic. Because, you know, just like all prisoners aren't nice guys, all guards aren't nice guys either. But they're not all evil either. I was helped a number of times. I can't even begin to count how many times I was helped along the way by a kind-hearted guard or official who saw something in me that I didn't even see in myself, and sometimes smuggled me books or did something for me that helped me in some small way. And true, it was small. But then my world was small, but that small act was a big thing in my life.
You make a very important distinction between long-term prison life and the transient populations moving in and out of local jails.
You know, really today, the worst place to serve your time is in jail, not prison. Prisons, because they have a long-term population, people who are there for years and most of their lives, they build a world, they build a community, a real society with values, with a code of do's and don'ts in terms of behavior, and they eventually have their own, established power structure. Whereas jails, they're just people in there for drunk, disorderly conduct. They're just in there for a few days or a few weeks, and they don't care about anything. They're just waiting to move on in their life, usually to get out of jail. So those are pretty bad places to be in. In fact, in all of my time incarcerated, the really hardest time I ever had was during the last 4 years of my incarceration while I was awaiting trial in the local jail, because those were youngsters and it's just a madhouse.
I understand that back in Angola, as well as the official rules and regulations, there were those disciplines imposed by the prisoners themselves, and that they were often tougher on each other than the official.
Prisoners are always tougher on each other than the administration would be. No matter how bad the administration is, they're never as bad on prisoners as prisoners are on each other. And I guess that's the reason when you put a whole lot of criminals together, you do need a higher force, a higher power kind of ruling over things.
You've got a lot of humor in you. Is humor an important ingredient, a survival technique in prison?
From what I've been reading, humor is a survival technique even in your world. I read now that people, they live better, they live healthier if they laugh. And humor, you know, sometimes it's gallows humor, but in prison, but, you know, we learn to laugh. Yeah, you laugh even at some really bad things. You find humor. Because you need it. The world you live in is just too serious.
Anyone reading your book will come to the conclusion that the really bad guy is a district attorney, Frank Salter, who seemed to make you the purpose of his life. He seemed to sort of focus all his venom, his crusading zeal, on making your life bloody impossible, and in fact trying to get you executed.
Yeah, and, you know, yes, he is the bad guy in my life. And in fact, and you said that, you know, it seemed like I was the major purpose in his life. You know, the great irony about his life, you know, about he and I. You were mentioning that I won national awards for my journalism. I've done all sorts of things. You see, when he died, when the district attorney died, I think it was a couple of years before my last trial, before I went free, the only thing they could put in the newspaper in his obituary is that he was the guy who prosecuted Wilbert Rito. In other words, that's his major accomplishment in life. That's sad.
He didn't just try this once. He prosecuted you three times. Right. He opposed your release from prison for 40 years. What was going on in his mind?
Well, what happened is that it's sort of like an exploit over at this conference last month that I attended. He told the attendees that, you know, he got involved in my case because it was the damnedest thing he had ever heard of. You know, you hear of innocent people sometimes getting framed, but why would you frame a guilty guy? And he said, that's what they did me. They framed me for their own political reasons and political objectives, and that's what this guy did. And I think the reason why he fought me so hard all that time is because once he married himself to a certain scenario and a certain objective, he couldn't separate himself from it because he was too identified with it. In fact, I think he even himself, emotionally and psychologically, I mean, just wrapped himself around me.
You've been very unlucky with district attorneys called yeah. Frank, because he then hands over the torch to Frank Bryant, who right. continued his depiction of you as the coldest-blooded killer in your very last trial in 2005.
Yes, and he called me all sorts of names. He did everything he could, and when he finished, it wasn't any good, because for the first time in all of those years, for the first time I had good lawyers, and I had a defense. I finally had a defense and was able to present evidence on my own behalf, and the jury looked at it all, listened to everything he had to say, and they didn't buy it.
Well, clearly, and we'll get into this later, you were guilty of manslaughter, but reading this, there's no way you were technically guilty mm-hmm. of murder. Look, let's start to tell that story now. And to set the scene, we've got to remember that 1960 was the year that Harper Lee published To Kill a Mockingbird. Not that you were probably a very big reader at that time. You didn't know the book. It's also the time when Louisiana is the center of the struggle on segregation. Let me ask you this. Were you conscious of the political struggle for civil rights going on around you as a 19-year-old black?
No, I wasn't. I was just, I guess for lack of better description, I was just a criminal. And for the most part, criminals don't read newspapers. They're not fused into the rest of the world. They're just fused into their own immediate needs, frustrations, and problems. And that's why they're so different. You know, you always hear these politicians talking about, we're going to get tough. We're going to execute people. We're going to do all sorts of things to send a message to the criminals not to commit crime in the future. But, you know, the problem is the criminals aren't listening because they don't read newspapers. They don't listen to what they're saying, so they don't watch the news, so it's lost.
Well, I'm going to be your defense attorney now, and I'm going to suggest you weren't a very serious criminal. I know you nicked a few things when you were a little boy. A lot of kids do. In fact, I don't know I've ever met a kid that didn't. But you'd shoplift a bit of, you know, cheap jewelry to impress a girl at school or something else to win a few friends. But, you know, as a young bloke, you were no better, but certainly no worse than anyone else. And you also, of course, had a job, and you were paid $35 a week as a cleaner in a store.
And that was good money back then. But I lived in a world that was sharply defined, divided and defined by race. My whole life, what I could do in life, was defined by race. I was raised by parents who, my father was brutal. My mother, she was well-intentioned and a good mother, but neither one, like my mother told me, you know, they didn't know anything about raising kids. They're just like a lot of parents. And as a result, I grew up without any direction, any guidance, and I just had to learn about life through trial and error, and I hit those rough teenage years, and I was very frustrated. I was tired of my life. I was to the point of being desperate, and I just wanted a different life or none at all.
Well, that brings us to the bank robbery, but first of all, the overwhelming impression I get of reading your story is a life of loneliness. It's a life of loneliness. Not anymore. Now you're happily married, pretty late in life, but he was a guy who, right from the beginning, was isolated. You talk about your father. Well, he leaves you, doesn't he? Which is not an uncommon experience for an African-American child. Then the boss in the store declines to give you a pay rise. You feel this is unfair, and it adds, it's further evidence that you're marginalized. And this seems to trigger the terrible events that happened so quickly.
You know, what it was, and I think this applies to a lot of people, I lived in a world that told me in so many different ways that I didn't count as a human being. I didn't matter. What I felt, what I wanted, my ambitions, my aspirations, nothing mattered. And I guess that just, you know, and then what happened, some of the things that was happening to me just pushed me over the edge.
But you didn't buy the gun or the knife for the purpose of robbing a bank. You bought that because there was some sort of incident in a black nightclub.
Well, I was a kid who didn't weigh 120 pounds soaking wet. And in fact, when I went to prison, the records will show you, when I was arrested, I think I was, it said that I was 5'7.5" tall. And years later, when they took me off death row, they measured me again. I was 5'9.5" tall. In other words, I grew. I was still a kid growing. And I was a little skinny kid, and, you know, I used to be bullied and intimidated, and I got tired of that, too, people pushing me around. And so, yes, I got a weapon because I knew that you wouldn't push me around if I had a weapon.
You talked about people getting their impressions of prison life from movies. You got your impressions of bank robberies from movies. You'd seen enough to think, well, this is easy. You just walk in, you wave a gun around, and they give me lots of money. It didn't work that way, though, did it?
No, it didn't. I went in intending to rob a bank. But like most things, I mean, things don't always go the way you want them to go. And people don't just go along with you. And things got out of control, and I ended up killing the bank teller.
I want to just get you to describe the incident, because what happens is you bundle three employees into one of their cars as hostages and drive away. That's when things really went wrong.
Right. Now, I was trying to skip past it because that is probably – that not no, probably. That's the worst thing I ever did in my life. It's the thing that I'm most ashamed of, most embarrassed by. And, you know, it's like most people in life who do wrong or who do something that really, really is shameful. They try to hide it in a closet. The only problem is I can't hide mine. I've had to live with it for a long time. So usually when people ask me, I try to just answer real quick and, you know, and hope they leave it alone.
I understand. I understand that, but I wanted the listener to come to terms with the fact that I'm sitting opposite a bloke who did kill a woman.
Right. When the car slowed, the woman who was driving jumped out, and she jumped out. The man jumped out, and it just all went to hell. And I started yelling, you know, hold it! And the guy reached for the gun and I just started shooting. I mean, things were out of hand. I mean, it's easy to say I panicked. I was also scared. And that's no excuse because I know they had to be terrified.
Something occurs shortly after. You are, in fact, made into an instant celebrity by the way the case was handled. Your interrogation was telecast.
Well, secretly, too. I didn't know I was on television. Understand, back then, television was just a budding industry. And they televised the sheriff questioning me, interrogating me, without my knowledge. I didn't know anything about it. And then they broadcast it all over. They've been broadcasting it ever since. But that was the thing that, because they did that, the United States Supreme Court said it was a kangaroo court and threw the conviction out, and that's what saved my life the first time.
It also, of course, polluted the jury. As the jury pool, they all saw this thing. But the jury is extraordinary. It's made up of relatives of the victim, two deputy sheriffs, a bank employee who knew one of the hostages, and everyone else were vividly aware of the televised interview. That jury fails any test.
You didn't finish the rest of it. It was all white, all men, because back then, before the civil rights movement, that was the old South. That's the way they handed out justice. The juries were always all white men, and black people only went to the courthouse to pay taxes, or you went to be punished or tried as a criminal. That's all.
I'm well aware, and the listeners are too, of the long history of injustice suffered by blacks facing criminal proceedings. And this is also standard procedure, it seems to me, in that you were given a couple of lawyers who had never tried a capital case and who had no criminal experience in any. So they were just irrelevant.
Well, at the first trial, the two, one was a bankruptcy lawyer and the other was a real estate lawyer. And when it came time, when the prosecution finished their case and it came time for them to put on my defense, they simply said the defense rest. And that was the end of the trial. I mean, no evidence for me, no witness for me, nothing. Just, that was it.
Well, we're not trying you now, Wilbert Rideau. We're interviewing you for Late Night Live on ABC Radio National. My guest, 44 years in prison, including 12 in solitary. His new autobiography is called In the Place of Justice. I knew a little about Angola. I'd heard about it far away in Australia. It was known as the Alcatraz of the South. And, of course, like Alcatraz of the North, the setting was daunting, wasn't it? Describe the physicality of where the prison is.
Probably like Dracula's castle. It's located in perhaps the most rugged, most desolate region of the state of Louisiana, in central Louisiana, just a few miles. In fact, one side of it is bordered by the state of Mississippi, but it's surrounded on three sides by the angry waters of the Mississippi River. And on the fourth side is bordered by steep ravines and a forbidding wilderness with all sorts of animals out there. And it's because of its geography, it doesn't really need a wall around it. It doesn't need a fence around it because few people manage to swim that Mississippi River, and very few guys are willing to take their chances out there in that wilderness.
And if it was dangerous outside, it was dangerous inside. And the one thing I hadn't comprehended was that it was largely run by an army of prison trustees who were pretty tough cookies.
In order to save money, what the state of Louisiana did is came up with this system of making guards out of prisoners. In other words, prisoners, and they would choose you based on whether or not you were willing to kill. So they would pick people who were in prison for murder or for killing somebody, and they would give them a gun and have them guard the rest of the prisoners. And they also were given the incentive because, if they shot a prisoner, they got 6 months off their sentence. But that's the way they ran the system. But look, even today, Now, they've disbanded that system. But even today, if you go to the governor's mansion in the capital city of Louisiana in Baton Rouge, if you go to see the governor or even at these balls or parties they have, all of the people, all of the men who are walking around there, who are the waiters, the butlers, all of them in these little tuxedos and whatnot, those are all murderers serving life.
There was a story, and the book reminds us, that 31 white prisoners had slashed their Achilles tendon to protest conditions. And there was a fear when you were there that the prison would return to that attitude, that state of mind, to the medieval slave camp of the past.
There was that fear because between 1972 and 1975, there were 67 prisoners who were stabbed to death. That's not counting the ones who were bludgeoned with baseball bats or even the ones who were just injured and stayed alive. That was a higher rate of murder than even in the cities of the United States. But the thing is, there was that fear, but fortunately, the federal court stepped in and ordered the state of Louisiana to clean up that penitentiary and to stop the violence.
The prison provides food, toothpaste, a toothbrush, toilet paper in restricted quantities. Mm-hmm. And for everything else, you had to effectively try and call room service because you had to pay for anything else, deodorant, soap, canned meat. And your mum would send you whatever money she could afford.
Well, she couldn't afford very much, so she'd send what she could. But ultimately, what I did is I ended up, once I became educated, I started writing letters for guys and two packs of cigarettes for a letter, three packs of cigarettes for a letter. And that's the way I would earn money.
I'm fascinated by the internal economy of the prison. Every prison has it, of course, but food was the most actively traded commodity, followed by sex, narcotics, porn, lingerie.
Well, that's for the gal boys. These are the weaker prisoners who they would force into the roles of becoming females, but they were literally enslaved. And as slaves, they were property as well. They could sell them, do whatever, gamble them off, whatever. But the lingerie was always for the enslaved population because, you know, guys who, they went through all the trouble of forcing these weaker prisoners to be, to serve the role as women. Well, naturally, you want them to look good. So they spent money on getting them lingerie and whatever else, that feminine things to make them look feminine.
Okay, let's go to the first appeal to the Supreme Court, made on the basis of racial discrimination, challenging the fact that your interview had been televised. Now, it turned out to be a rerun of the first trial. You were reconvicted and again set to face to face execution, which down here is the electric chair. I must ask you in parenthesis, did you constantly obsess about death? Were you always thinking about the approach of the execution, or did you manage to find techniques to get it out of your mind?
I didn't obsess about it, no. You have to understand, being a black in the South, I knew that any time a black kills a white person, they will kill you. I knew that from day one. So I had always assumed they're going to kill me. It's just that I had come to prison. I had gotten into this fix because I was ignorant. And my intention was that I would, to the extent that I could, I wasn't going to stay ignorant. Even if it was only to die, at least I'd die with a little knowledge. I mean, so what I did is I spent all of my time in that cell reading. And I read virtually a little library. So that is why, you know, I was off in the reading. I wouldn't even think about the execution because I just assume they're going to do it. So I didn't worry about it. I'd come to terms with, I'm going to die.
You must have known quite a few blokes who did die.
Yeah. In fact, even, yes, back then, and the biggest irony is that later on, when I became editor of the magazine, it was my job to go back to death row, and for the next 25 years, cover all the executions in Louisiana.
You're talking to a country which gave up capital punishment many, many years ago. It just doesn't happen, and no one has ever seriously suggested we should reintroduce it. What's your attitude to it?
I think Australia is a great country. I think Australia has the right attitude. I think that there are people, and I know some, there are some people who need to be locked up for the rest of their lives. I mean, if it was within my power to let them go, I would keep them locked up because I don't want them out here because I have a mother, I have myself, I have people I care about, and I know they're dangerous. But most people aren't like that. And, you know, you don't have to execute somebody. Execute them for what? Once you've got them locked up in a cell, I know some guys in Angola right now who've been in a cell for 40 years. So where was the need to execute them?
And the fact is that recidivism with murder is very, very rare.
You're absolutely correct. Murderers have possessed the lowest recidivism rate of the entire criminal spectrum, and it's just not. The problem is that in the United States, they have so demonized people who commit crimes, especially violence, because that's what people are most afraid of. They're not afraid of, you know, Bernie Madoff stealing so much money, got people jumping out of the windows and committing suicide. That's killing people. But they're afraid of the person who puts a gun in your face and all that, and rightfully so. But the thing is, it's like you say, they have a very low recidivism rate. It isn't necessary to kill them. Once you've incapacitated them, you've made them helpless, kill them for what?
And most murders are within families, too, around the world. I have observed, however, that the murderer, even in an Australian prison, does enjoy a special status. And you found that you had this, because when you went into the general population, which was a frightening prospect for you, you discovered that they tended to be more frightened of you.
Well, I could thank the district attorneys and law enforcement for doing that because, you know, in order to get the public to see the rightness in executing somebody, giving them a death penalty and executing them, they really demonize you. They make you the worst of they make the public see you as being Jack the Ripper or Dracula, you know, so the public will say, oh, yeah, okay, he needs to be killed. But the flip side of the coin is when, you know, by demonizing like that, yes, you make the public afraid of you, but you've made those other prisoners afraid of you too, so they leave you alone.
What were you reading? How were you educating yourself?
Well, unlike a lot of people, I had to read initially. My reading was on a catch-as-catch-can basis, and that's the case for most prisoners. Because, you know, even where there's libraries, they're so small, they don't have the selection that you would have at any other library. Initially, I was reading smuggled books. I was reading, because they didn't let us have anything initially other than Bibles and religious literature. And so I had to read smuggled books. And at first, it was the first book I read was Fair Oaks by Frank Yeboah. It was about slavery. But back then, a lot of the books I ended up reading were books about cowboys. Because, understand, most of the books that were smuggled in the prison were smuggled by the white prisoners. And they like cowboys. So that's what I ended up reading a whole lot of Louis L'Amour and all that. You know, the cowboy the Westerns, until I was able to do better.
Okay, that's you as a reader. Let's now get on to you as a writer, because this was the way you transformed your life. You become a writer, you become an editor, for heaven's sake. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the newspaper and what you did for it and with it.
Well, the first thing I did was I got an understanding with the Director of Corrections that it would be there would be no censorship. In other words, me and my staff would be free to pursue and investigate and publish anything that we could substantiate. And understand, he agreed. But understand, this was totally unprecedented in American history. This had never happened before. And he agreed because he felt that, you know, what's the worst we could do? Tell the truth? The truth was bad enough. I mean, you know, he felt that if the public knew the truth, knew just how horrific the place was, that perhaps they would be more inclined to help change it. And so that's what we just operated the same way any newspaper anywhere in the United States did.
No, that's not what you did. I've worked for newspapers for half a century, and I have to tell you that newspapers do not, in fact, tell the truth. They are not uncensored. All of us work with self-censorship. We know what we can get away with. You were in a very privileged position in prison.
That's true. I didn't have to worry about revenue or advertisers or any of that. I didn't have to worry about any of that. So you're absolutely right. I was free to just follow my nose and do whatever interests me. And the thing is, we always chose stories based on potential impact, the potential to make a difference. But it was very good work. It was work that allowed me to turn what would have been an otherwise meaningless existence into a very meaningful one for me.
Let's look at, take a year at random. I'm fibbing, of course. I've got notes here. 1975, what a year in Angola's modern history. 160 stabbings, 17 killings every other day, mm-hmm. A major violent event. There wouldn't have been another prison in the U.S. that bad.
I don't know about other prisons, but that one was bad enough. Now, back then, a lot of prisons were bad. But that was, 1975 was the watershed. That's when federal courts around the country began ordering state officials to clean up their prisons, or they would send the state officials to prison, you know, for criminal contempt if they didn't do it. And that's when they started finally providing money. They pumped so much money in the prisons until it wasn't even funny. And that's why they were able to clean up everything, and that's why today you happen to have a prison industrial complex, which is just sucks off so much money until it's... And it's very all non-productive.
Perhaps the military industrial complex from which you've borrowed that phrase, coined by Dwight Eisenhower. But of course, going back a little bit earlier, you were saying that when all this was happening to you as a kid, you weren't exactly reading To Kill a Mockingbird, and you weren't taking an hourly interest in the political events around you. But the civil rights movement did reach Angola, didn't it?
It changed some of Angola, yes. It had an effect because it forced them to finally allow blacks to become employees in prison, because it was an all-white world. You know, although black prisoners made up 85% of the population in prison, it was ruled by whites, and those were the only people allowed to work. And you know, the influx of black employees, that changed things. It also changed the way they operated prison. In other words, they could no longer allow the prison newspaper and all the other good jobs to be held by whites, because in the past they'd make the blacks work in the cotton fields and the whites would have all the good jobs, the office jobs and whatnot. And all that changed. So that allowed me to go into the prison newspaper office.
Almost every time I interview anyone in Louisiana on any subject, at some point they seem to think that God is looking after them or the oil industry. You mentioned God, but are you particularly religious?
I'm religious in that I believe that there's something going on that we don't understand. And I know a lot of people say they do understand because they talk personally with God and all that, but I don't buy any of it. But I do believe that there's some things we don't understand, because how can you account for me? How can I account for my life? I mean, that has been spared so many times, it's not even funny. Nobody has that much luck in this world. I mean, luck is like a rubber band. You can stretch it so far and then it snaps on you, usually when you need it the most. But I don't have much truck with organized religion, institutional religion. They're sort of like Holy General Motors, you know, the businesses. But I do believe that there's something, I don't know what, a creator, God, if you will, who is responsible for all this. And for some reason or another, I get the feeling that they like me.
This is LNL, ABC Radio National. It's coming to you from my hotel room in New Orleans, and I'm talking to Wilbert Rideau. 44 years in the slammer, including 12 in solitary, and the book, the autobiography, is called In the Place of Justice. Who was the great warden, the one that really helped your life along?
That would be C. Paul Phelps. He was my mentor. I mean, he was the director of corrections, but he took an interest in me because of my writing, and he also felt that I knew more about the prison system than all of his employees, so he'd often come to my office and we'd always talk, and he started taking me, you know, once he said, okay, you know, no censorship, and we could report and publish whatever, and we were supposed to become a credible source of information for both inmates and employees. Well, he realized that freedom from censorship isn't worth much if you don't know what's going on and if you don't have the means to access information. So he started taking me around to management meetings, Department of Corrections meetings, and, you know, I'm going to places where no prisoners had ever gone before, and let me see how they operate and let me listen to them and whatnot. So he taught me the business of corrections. He taught me how they manage, and he taught me a whole lot of things, and that's where I learned, just like newspapers, people learn everywhere else, follow the money. You follow the money even in prison. But he also taught me how to be a responsible human being, that I had obligations that exceeded just my immediate relationships and associates, you know.
So he negotiated the rights versus responsibilities argument with you?
Yes, he did. And I learned a lot from him. I mean, I learned a lot from reading, and I learned a lot from my own experiences, but he taught me quite a bit about morality and about civic obligations. And because I always thought, just like a lot of prisoners, you know, I'm not obligated to do anything about this prison. This is society's prison. They want to clean it up, they can clean it up. I didn't have anything to do with it.
Yeah, but you had more and more to do with it because you effectively became the ombudsman, didn't you?
Yes. I found myself in that posture because I didn't know that. I didn't realize what I was getting into initially. All this grew on me. But once I realized that as editor, I was in a position that I had the power to make a difference because I had the freedom of the press. And I realized, you know, I was in a posture to help a lot of people or to hurt people. And so I guess being editor and ombudsman, there's a lot, it's almost the same thing.
Now, we're giving the impression that suddenly you're on the yellow brick road and you're dancing around towards the Wizard of Oz, but things didn't just go well. There were reversals, weren't there? Because in the 1990s, you had to deal with Warden Bert Kane, and he was a censor.
He started putting the brakes on us, yes. We had operated for, 20 years, I think, without censorship. And all the previous wardens had all okayed it. But then Burl Kane came along, and he looked at it differently, and he said he wasn't going to censor us, but he lied. he was a politician, and he started gradually putting the brakes on us to the point where he was actually censoring everything. I mean, he had brought it all to a halt.
How did you win that fight?
I didn't win it. I got out of prison.
Louisiana politics has been famous around the world for a long, long time, and I can't help but smile when I see references to Huey Long on freeways. Mm-hmm. But there's another character, former Louisiana Governor Edwards, and the television program 2020 dropped a bombshell when it revealed a secret promise that Edwards had made to bank teller Dora McCain that he would never free you, no matter what. And Edwards admitted to this. Now, I find this doubly interesting because Edwards finished up in jail himself.
Yes, he's serving time right now in a federal prison in Louisiana. Not too far away from where I live at. Where I live as a free man now. It is ironic, and, you know, they've been trying to get him out, and I'll be honest with you. I mean, I was asked this recently. You know, ask about the irony, and you know, how do I feel about his efforts to get out of prison? And to be quite frank with you, I'm not a politician. I'm not hard-hearted. I don't believe he should stay in prison. I think if I had the keys, I'd let him out of prison.
Despite the fact that he's spectacularly corrupt.
That's him. That's not me. I have to do that for me.
You've had a Rip Van Winkle experience. You go into prison at 19. You come out 44 years later. The world must have shocked and astonished you.
I've been out 5.5 years, and it still astonishes me. I'm still learning. Everything has been amazing. I mean, nothing short of shocking. I'm still a gawking tourist walking down the street, and I just gawk at everything, and I make no apologies for it. You know, this just the way it is. When I got out of prison, I mean, understand, the world I left, 44 years before then, it's like night and day. I mean, back then you had, two different kinds of razors for men. It was, a double edge or single edge? That's all they had, and they were all made by Gillette. But I stepped out, I went to Walmart to get a razor, and I mean, damn, that's a whole wall of razors. I mean, I didn't know what to do. I ended up buying a little cheap Bic razor, the same way, the kind we use in prison, until I could, I had lunch one day with the editor of the newspaper here in New Orleans, and I asked him, and he told me what he used, and that's what I went and bought, and I still use it today. But these automated telephones, everything is huge. Homes are huge. The cars are huge. I mean, they didn't make these SUVs. They're wagons. They're like armored tanks. People are huge. I mean, you know, when I left the world, I mean, you know, every now and then you see a fat person or a person overweight, but, I mean, now that's common.
This is the only city on earth where I feel like Twiggy. This is the land of the giants. But let me suggest something else has changed. There's a black man in the White House.
Well, even before then, when I got out, there were black people behind cash registers in Walmart and all these stores. You have to understand, in the old South, they didn't allow black people to handle money and do all that. I mean, there are black people in banks, and I mean, to me, that was shocking. And then they told me, yeah, and there are supervisors, managers, and officials, and
They're not going in there to rob the banks.
No, they're not. You know, and now they don't just go in the courthouse to be judged or punished. Now they're sitting in the courthouse as judges and as DAs and their own juries. And, I mean, it's different. Everything is different. It takes some getting used to.
Is it all better or some of it of dubious value, like having an infinite choice of razors?
Well, it creates a whole lot of indecision for me because the wide variety, you know, that often throws me into indecision. But no, a lot of it is better. I don't believe in that old thing about the good old days. The good old days were never good. I think we're at our best today. There's some things that are missing, yes, things that sort of disappeared. Like, so the community was closer knit. They were closer together when I was coming up. Now I'm in a beautiful neighborhood, fantastic, but, and you know, everybody's nice, but there isn't that closeness that, you know, you've got neighbors and they're all nice, but they're not like they used to be. They don't take an interest in each other and work together and do like they used to do. It's different.
What's it like being married?
That's wonderful. I mean, you know, for a guy who spent all his life alone, that's fantastic. I mean, you know, what can I say? You got somebody to put your arms around? I mean, somebody, you don't do this in prison, you know? you got a woman to put her arms around you. You got regular sex. You've got everything. I mean, you know, it's great. In fact, my wife's biggest complaint is that I stalk her. And I always point out to her, she tells everybody that. And I said, hey, I just want to be close to you. That's all. I don't want to leave you. What can I say?
As I said at the beginning of our chat, the overwhelming impression of most of your life has been of your loneliness. And that has now been cured.
My loneliness? Yeah. I'm no longer alone. I found my perfect match. I didn't find her, she found me. And I also learned the key to happiness. It's a simple two words. Yes, dear.
Well, on that happy note, I'll say yes, dear, to you. And, Walter, thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Philip. It's indeed a pleasure.
Wilbert Rideau's book, In the Place of Justice, is published now by Knopf. And my thanks to producers Gail Basario and Sasha Fegan. Next Thursday, again from New Orleans, we speak to musicians and writers from David Simon's celebrated new show, Tremé. It's right next to the French Quarter, where slaves once congregated to make music and dance, and was the centre of the free black culture in the South prior to the Civil War. So tune in again next week, meet some extraordinary people. The news is next on ABC Radio National.